Okay, I got it. So this is Bio 241. This is our second lecture session, and we're going to finish up Chapter 1, move on to Chapter 2, which is chemistry. You don't have to be a super chemist in here, but we do have to talk about chemistry a little bit. And don't forget, if you don't sign in, you are absent, and that is really difficult since this is the first week of class, because I might have to drop you if you're not attending class, and if you're not attending lab as scheduled. Yes, hi. Yeah, I'm going to do that right now, but thanks for reminding me. Let's see which one. Not that one I like. I'm going to dim that one. Okay, I could also dim this one, but I think that might be a little bit too dark, right? That's still too dark, right? Even after our eyes adjust, I think that is too dark. So we're going to leave it like this. Okay, so we have this one projector working. This is fantastic. So before I start finishing up homeostasis, are there any questions at all? Does anybody have a question that I could answer that might help you get over maybe a little point of confusion before we move on? Pointer options? Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, actually, in lab, you're supposed to draw and label it. Oh, I can't quite hear you. Got to really speak up. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Maybe just see me after class, and I'll find out who your instructor is, okay, in lab period. Yeah, that was an opportunity. This is such an important diagram. This is like a keystone of the whole class, that you should really commit this to memory. The other thing is that it is an exam figure. If you look at the study guide, this is one of the figures that I could photocopy and put on the test, your first test. So you want to be really familiar with this diagram. So let's go over it. Okay. So I think maybe we were right here last time. All right, so here is a response loop. This is how you're going to analyze homeostasis in all the different systems that we're going to look at. And homeostasis is maintained with a response loop. And remember, a response loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends in a response. All right, so the stimulus and response will be the same physiologic parameter. So if the stimulus is an increase in temperature or a decrease in temperature, what is the response going to be? It's going to be having to do with temperature, right? So if the stimulus is an increase or decrease in pressure, the response is something to do with blood pressure. Or if it's glucose concentration, if the stimulus is a change in glucose, then the response is going to be a corresponding change in glucose, right? And it could go up or down. Okay, so response and stimulus will be the same physiologic parameter. And, of course, in order to appreciate a change in some physiologic parameter, you have to have a sensor or receptor. All right, so if there is a change in light intensity in the room, you can only tell that there is a change of light intensity if what? If you have what? If you have eyes, right? If unfortunately you're blind, then you can't tell if there's a change in light intensity in the room, right? So you got to have a receptor. And then that information is passed on via an afferent pathway. There's got to be a pathway for that information to get to the integration center. And does anybody know where you have the perception of light and the consciousness of light and being able to understand whether it's textual information or color information or graphic information or whatever? What part of your body does that? What part of your body? Think anatomy. That's a hint. In anatomy, you learn this. In your brain, and more importantly, since you took anatomy, you know all the different minute parts of the brain. What is a small part of the brain that signal goes to? It is the? Okay, how about which lobe? Okay, it is for visual information. It is the occipital lobe. Okay, was there summer break? Oh, there was summer break, okay, a couple months ago. All right, so you're going to have to review your anatomy. So the integration center usually is in a lot of cases, the central nervous system, and a lot of integration centers are located in the spinal cord, but there are still a lot in the medulla, okay, and maybe even higher centers in the brain. And the integration center is important because it takes information from all over the place and it adds it together, tries to make sense out of it, right? So integration center, for instance, if all of a sudden we hear the fire alarm going off, beep, 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 all right, so we hear the fire alarm, okay, but we don't see any flashing lights, we probably have a pretty good idea, most of us, that that is a fire alarm, and we probably want to get our things together and leave the room, right? But what other kind of senses could you have? You could have your visual information, and maybe now you see the flashing alarm and the sound of the alarm going, and then you might be a little bit more motivated to leave the room because your integration center, all the information is adding up that there is danger in the building, right? But what happens if there is the fire marshal walking into the room and he says, just as the fire alarm goes off, you know, this is just a test, we don't want you to leave. All right, so then we have what? More information, integration center processes that information. So now we know it's just a test and we don't have to leave the building. So the integration center is going to have different information, come up with a different decision. All right, now what decision are you going to make if you hear the alarm, the fire alarm, and you see the flashing light, but also now you start to smell something, like something burning. All right, now what is the integration center going to do? You're going to be really motivated to get your stuff together, right? Proceed through a safe and clear exit outside of the building. So the integration center gets all kinds of different information. So it analyzes all of the information and makes a decision, like to get up and leave the room, right? So that means that decision has to be sent out through an efferent pathway to effectors. In that particular case, we're talking muscles, so that you're motivated to leave the building. And what do muscles do? They produce this response right here. Okay, so analysis and decision making is made by the integration center. So if we think of something that's maybe not so complicated as that, maybe temperature, for instance, right? Temperature information goes to the integration center, and in a simple case like temperature, right, your body temperature is compared to something in order for the integration center to make a decision. Does anybody know what your actual body temperature is compared to so that the integration center can make a decision? And we see it on this list right here. It is the set point, right? Okay, so the set point is just the absolute normal value. But remember, you can deviate a little bit from the set point and still be in a healthy, disease-free state. All right, so there are little variations above or below the set point, but nonetheless, your body is going to start to make corrections for any deviation away from a set point. So, for instance, right now, what do you think your body temperature is? 98.6, really close to that, right? But in order to be in a normal, healthy state, your body temperature doesn't have to stay exactly at 98.6. It could go up a little bit. All right, and go down a little bit as long as it doesn't vary too much. That's what homeostasis means. So if you were to start exercising, what happens to your body temperature? Does it stay exactly at 98.6? You're shaking your head no. Okay, convince me. Why? How do you know this? Because so you start to exercise, and what do you do when you start to exercise? You start to sweat, okay? And the reason why you're sweating is because your body temperature is increasing. If your body temperature when you're exercising stays at 98.6, you won't start sweating. That's as simple as it is, right? So that's nice confirmation. So make sure you commit this diagram right here to memory, and we'll be working with this a little bit. So in terms of temperature, if you have an increase in body temperature, and it goes through this whole response loop right here, if your body temperature increases, all right, and then you start to sweat, what's going to happen to your body temperature when all of that water on the surface of your body starts to evaporate? It's going to lower the body temperature. That will cool you down. So the response is cooling of your body, right? So decrease in body temperature. What was the stimulus again? It was what, an increase or decrease in body temperature?
Increase.
An increase in body temperature. The response was a decrease in body temperature. And when you put those two things together, mathematically, do they add together or do they subtract from each other? They subtract, right? So the response will affect the stimulus right here, right? That closes the loop. And if it subtracts, if the response subtracts from the stimulus, that's a negative feedback loop, right? And remember that negative feedback is usually what produces, it does produce a normal, healthy, disease-free state. Okay. If it adds together, then we call that positive feedback, and that will drive you away from the set point. All right, so negative feedback in control system parlance is a good, healthy thing to have in terms of biology. All right, so what are some other little features we have right here? Response loop always begins with a stimulus and it ends in a response. And if the response and stimulus add together to drive you away from the set point, that's positive feedback. If the response and stimulus subtract from each other and it drives that parameter toward the set point again, right, that's negative feedback, and that produces a healthy compensated state. All right, so here are the two kinds of feedback in a text format. So negative feedback, remember, that is the good kind of feedback to have. So it's any kind of body mechanism where there's a change from an ideal normal value, like a stimulus, all right, is made smaller or resisted. Negative feedback leads to a compensated healthy state and maintains homeostasis. All right, so homeostasis doesn't mean that a physiologic parameter is absolutely constant. It means it can change as long as it always drifts back down toward the set point. Okay, so response subtracts from the stimulus. Positive is really the opposite kind of thing, where some body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made greater. So if your body temperature increases, a positive feedback mechanism would further increase your body temperature, which then, through that same positive feedback mechanism, would make you warmer, right, and then warmer and warmer, and then what did I say in a very jocular way last time? If your body temperature is in the control of positive feedback mechanisms, you got hotter and hotter and hotter, and then all of a sudden you'd explode in a big fireball, okay? Well, that doesn't quite happen because you actually expire before that happens, right, and that physically, that really doesn't happen. Okay, so homeostasis, a couple different ways we can think about it. In terms of control, there can be intrinsic control. Regulatory mechanisms, intrinsic control means that it has to do with the organ that is being regulated. And a really good, important example of this is the heart, and it's called the Frank-Starling Law. You'll become familiar with this when we get to the cardiovascular chapter, but usually, because if you have a healthy heart, the Frank-Starling Law is operating, and the Frank-Starling Law just says as more blood is presented to the heart, as the heart fills up with blood, all right, it gets stronger, which is nice because there might be conditions where all of a sudden a lot of blood is released and presented to the heart, and the heart fills up with a lot of blood, and it's a really nice thing that the heart has the ability to get stronger so that it can pump that additional blood. So that happens with us all the time. It's a very nice mechanism. Sometimes, though, it works to our disadvantage, unfortunately. But since we know the Frank-Starling Law, we can adapt to that if we're in a clinical practice very readily. Some of you are EMTs in here, and you probably know this. For instance, when might there be a circumstance where you don't have blood returning to the heart? Okay, for instance, if you have, what? Stroke is an insult to the brain, but you still might have blood returning to the heart. We're just thinking about the heart itself, and not other, since we're intrinsic, we're talking about intrinsic mechanism. Heart attack, oh, you still might have heart blood returning to the heart, but the heart can't respond because it's abnormal. Let's just think we have a normal heart, but something is happening to the blood. It's not returning to the heart. Like, for instance, if you have an aneurysm and it ruptures, for instance, so what I'm thinking about is blood loss or hemorrhage. So if you lacerate yourself or if an aneurysm breaks someplace in your body and your cardiovascular system loses blood, right? Like maybe, like I said, you lacerated yourself, so instead of blood in your body, it's running out on the ground. Less blood can do what? Go back to the heart. So now the heart is not receiving blood. It doesn't fill up, and this is a terrible circumstance that has to be corrected. Then the heart gets what? It gets weaker. Just when you need a nice, strong heart, right, because it's not filling up with blood, it automatically gets weaker. That's the intrinsic part of the control of the heart, the Frank-Starling Law. So as the heart gets weaker because blood is not returning to the heart because you have a hemorrhage, right? What is one of the nice, easy, fast things we can do for somebody? Well, first of all, you need to stop the bleeding, okay? Otherwise, nothing will help. But you can give them an IV. You can at least give them fluids. You can give them saline, which increases their blood volume. It returns some blood or volume to the heart, so now the heart starts to fill up with at least salt water again partially. And what happens to the heart as it starts to stretch? It gets stronger, and so now it's pumping more efficiently. So that is really handy. So sometimes this Frank-Starling law or that intrinsic property of the heart works really nicely for you. Other times, right, it can really hurt you, but people are aware of it. And one of the first things we do is certainly maintain blood volume in people so that the heart remains nice and strong. And that's just an intrinsic property of the heart. It doesn't require any reflexes from the spinal cord or brain or anything like that. Okay, let's talk about extrinsic mechanisms. Now, extrinsic mechanisms require things from outside of the organ, like the brain, for instance. All right. So a good example here, body temperature controlled by antagonistic effects of sweating and shivering. All right, so let's think about core body temperature, some organ maybe like your liver, deep inside your body. Now, what's going to maintain temperature of your liver is not the liver itself, but it could be due to muscles, right? When you get cold, muscles will start to contract. That will increase body temperature. That will increase liver temperature. Or if the liver gets too hot, the organ system that is going to compensate for increasing liver temperature is which organ system? Okay, I know it's been a whole summer since anatomy. But what are the integumentary system? Yeah, integumentary system, right? So these other organ systems will help maintain the proper physiologic parameter of the liver. So in this particular example, is this person in homeostasis? Okay, you should recognize that immediately. And you can say yes because I see the normal range right here and the temperature decreases and increases, but it never goes beyond the normal range. So this person is in homeostasis. Furthermore, what type of feedback is operating in this graphic right here? And why do you say that? Somebody said negative feedback, and that is fantastic, because why? Because as you deviate away from the set point right here, which is 37 degrees, what happens to body temperature? It starts to correct itself and goes back to the set point. And when it overshoots, that's okay. That still is homeostasis. If what? If eventually it starts to drift back down to the set point. So if you see a deviation from set point, right, matched by some correction back to the set point, that's got to be negative feedback. If it's positive feedback and we're on this limb of the curve, what would happen? It would increase, and then what would happen? It would still increase, and then it would increase and increase and increase above the normal range, and then that would produce what? A disease state. All right, so don't forget, homeostasis is really a dance of all of these parameters in your body. So when you sweat, when you get overheated, your body compensates by losing fluid, right? And fluid balance, water balance in your body, that's a homeostatic parameter as well. So here is one parameter, then water, you lose water, but that helps maintain body temperature. All right, and then what happens to water? Oh, then your kidneys get excited and say, oh, well, we better conserve water. Your thirst center turns on, right? So water goes up and down, temperature goes up and down, but none of these things so much that it produces a disease state. So when all these things are dancing around each other just a little bit, that's good. That produces homeostasis. Nothing is ever constant, absolutely constant inside the body. All right, so here we have another example of extrinsic control. We're talking about blood glucose concentration. So here's a plot of blood glucose concentration in milligrams per deciliter versus what parameter down over here? Versus time. So we're just looking at glucose concentration in your blood, and that's a homeostatically controlled parameter in your body because our brains just love to use glucose to make ATP. It's regulated by some hormones, and these hormones are secreted by the pancreas, and it's helped controlled also by the liver, right? So a lot of different organs are involved in maintaining blood glucose concentration. So it's not intrinsic because it's not the property of the blood that's regulating glucose in the blood. It is all these other organs, like the pancreas, right? Maybe the brain to some extent, and the liver. So what I want you to see on this example right here, well, let's describe it a little bit. So we got blood glucose concentration versus time, and we see that if we inject this hormone insulin, it takes a big drastic drop right here. All right, so that is just we're forcing this person's body to misbehave. But what kind of feedback mechanism is working when we notice that blood glucose concentration then goes back to normal? What kind of feedback mechanism is that? Okay, so if you go back to that previous slide, we said this is negative feedback because this parameter always goes back to the set point, no matter which way, right, it is perturbed. So the perturbation here is just one simple decrease in blood glucose concentration, but it goes back to the set point. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So other things are happening inside the body, okay, to maintain blood glucose. Okay, so that's really what I want you to see on this diagram, that this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, positive feedback. Here are some examples of positive feedback that we'll probably look at through the course of the semester. Positive feedback, it's rare, but it amplifies that stimulus. It makes the stimulus greater. All right, blood coagulation. There's a positive feedback mechanism that happens when you cut yourself, right? And blood, remember, what kind of tissue is blood, just for fun? It's a connective tissue, kind of a strange connective tissue because it's not solid like a bone. It's not really strong like collagen, for instance. It's a fluid connective tissue, right? And it's inside a blood vessel, so when you damage a blood vessel and you put a hole in a blood vessel, that connective tissue does what? It just flows right out because it's a fluid under most circumstances. But it does have the ability, one property of blood is to preserve itself. It can form clots. And you think it's a good idea to be able to form a clot in a hurry? Or, I mean, do you have a day or a week or a couple of weeks to figure out what to do with that hole in your blood vessel? No, your body has evolved so that it clots over that hole in a blood vessel very rapidly. One of the things that allows blood to clot rapidly is a positive feedback mechanism. Right? So coagulation, blood clotting, involves a positive feedback mechanism. We'll look at that when we get to blood. Also, ovulation. Okay, so females create a surge in luteinizing hormone, all right, which then causes, let me think real quick. Luteinizing hormone causes some estrogen and progesterone to increase. So luteinizing hormone comes from the pituitary gland that causes an increase of production and release of progesterone and estrogen. And in that part of the ovulatory cycle, that causes the increase in LH to be released from the pituitary, which causes more estrogen and progesterone to be released, which then causes more luteinizing hormone to be released, which then causes what? More estrogen and progesterone. Okay, so how come the whole world isn't filled up with estrogen and progesterone and luteinizing hormone if they cause each to increase? Because something drastic happens, and that is ovulation, right? And then the nature of the ovary changes completely, and then these levels start to decrease. But that big surge in LH causes ovulation. Positive feedback in parturition. We talked about this last time. Okay, where the stress hormone, namely a steroid, a corticosteroid, causes from the fetus, causes an increase in oxytocin from the mom, which then causes more stress and release of corticosteroid from the fetus, which then causes more oxytocin. All right, so here's a positive feedback mechanism. And again, the question could be, how come the whole world or universe isn't filled up with oxytocin? Because a positive feedback mechanism can't go on forever. Something drastic happens. And in this particular case, it's a normal occurrence, though it probably doesn't feel very normal, but it is a normal, healthy occurrence, and that is what? Delivery of a baby. And then the whole situation changes, right? Then another example right here would be an action potential. And we're going to look at action potentials, some electrical activity inside your body. So I tell you what, here's a kind of fun question. Is your body very electrical in nature? Is your body electrical, or are you just kind of like biology? Or is electricity a very important part of your body? Yes, your body is very electrical, all right? And that's one of the first things we're going to look at in this class. Okay, some regulatory mechanisms. We sort of talked about this. right? But always think of this diagram right here in the terms of that response loop that I want you to draw in lab. Okay. So here is a response loop. And let's just say that you're lying down. You're doing a pretty good job of lying down right now. You're sitting down, so you're halfway lying down right now. And when you stand up, even if you're sitting down, your blood pressure is going to drop. All right, and so that's going to be a stimulus when blood pressure falls. All right, that's the stimulus right there. And your blood pressure might drop so far that blood stops going to your brain. And remember, oxygen is necessary in your brain to make ATP. You might lose consciousness. So this is a pretty serious condition. We don't want you to lose consciousness. Your body should maintain consciousness even though you're changing body position. All right, so in order for your body to recognize that your blood pressure dropped, what does it need? Okay, we said a response loop always starts with a stimulus, which we already defined right here. That's a decrease in blood pressure, but you're not going to have the slightest clue your blood pressure is decreasing unless you have what inside your body? A receptor for pressure, right? And those are pressure receptors. Anybody have a more specific name for pressure receptors inside your body? That's locations. It's important for you guys to know where the locations are, but they are called baroreceptors, right? You picked that up in lab this week. Baroreceptors, they're in a couple different locations in your body. That's the sensor, and then these sensors send that information, because that's not the integration center, send this information via sensory nerves to the medulla, because that's where the cardioregulatory system is, in the medulla. And it compares what your blood pressure is to something. What does it compare it to? The set point, right? And it says, aha, blood pressure is decreasing, and it's not at the set point. It's got to make a decision. So it's going to send its decision to somehow, what? Increase blood pressure so that you can maintain consciousness. So it sends information to the heart, right? That's going to be one of the effectors in the system. In lab, you have some much more elegant slides than this one right here. But the sympathetic nervous system then will increase the rate and force of contraction of the heart that will increase blood pressure. So here is a rise in blood pressure. This is then the response. How does this response compare to the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract? It subtracts. So what kind of feedback loop is this? That's a nice negative feedback loop. You maintain consciousness. That keeps you in a nice, healthy, disease-free state, because your head doesn't bounce off the table and then the chair and then the floor. That's really nice when that does not happen when you stand up. Okay, so then that is how homeostasis is maintained by a nice negative feedback loop by this example right here. Okay, here are a couple other feedback loops, and you can tell me if they're positive or negative. And again, it has to do with blood glucose levels. When you're in a fed state, when you're eating something or just done eating, you're absorbing glucose from the nutrition that you've just eaten, and it's absorbed into the blood, so your blood glucose goes up. And remember, it's a homeostatically controlled parameter. It shouldn't go too high, because that can produce death. Can't go too low, because that will produce death. All right, so it's increasing. The integration center is in the pancreas, and in particular, the islets of Langerhans. Notice a increase in blood glucose, and so as a result, they will secrete insulin into the blood. Most cells in your body require insulin in order to take insulin up from the blood. They will starve to death unless there is an insulin signal. All right, so even though somebody has high glucose in their blood, it can't enter cells unless there's also what? The passport for glucose to get into a cell. What is that passport signal? It is insulin, right? So the cells in your body will starve to death, right, unless they have that insulin signal. So in this particular case, in a healthy, normal individual, there's an increase in insulin. And so glucose can now enter cells, like muscle cells. And so these cells take up glucose from the blood. So what happens to blood glucose concentration then? As it's taken up, going into other parts of your body, then blood glucose concentration decreases. So that is the response. What is the initial stimulus? An increase in blood glucose. How does it relate to the response? They subtract from each other, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. And so blood glucose concentration is driven which way? farther from the set point or toward the set point? Toward the set point, maintaining a nice healthy state. All right, so that's in a fed state. If you're in a fasting state, you don't have any food in your GI tract to absorb glucose from, so your blood glucose will have a tendency to go down. So you have decreasing blood glucose. The pancreas, again, monitors that, so there are receptors for glucose in the pancreas, and it makes a decision to stop secreting insulin, because what's the effect of insulin? It's going to decrease, yeah, it's going to lower blood glucose. Ah, but that is the, where's my little arrow, but that is the stimulus right here, right? So it makes a decision to decrease the amount of insulin that it's secreting and increase glucagon. Probably everybody has heard of insulin. Maybe not many people have heard of glucagon, but it is a hormone that works with insulin, but in an antagonistic way. It has an opposite effect. Glucagon will increase blood glucose. All right, so what does insulin do? It decreases blood glucose. Insulin decreases blood glucose, but glucagon, on the other hand, increases blood glucose for the following reason. Right, glucose can work on the liver, and there is a storage form of glucose in the liver called glycogen. And when the liver gets a glucagon signal, it will go to glycogen and snip off little pieces of glucose and put it in the blood. And when it snips off glucose from glycogen, puts it in the blood, what happens to glucose concentration in the blood? It goes up. Right, so it has the opposite effect as insulin. All right, so if you decrease insulin, cellular uptake is decreased. So if glucose is not taken up by cells, where does it stay? In the blood. That's why somebody who's a diabetic, even though they haven't eaten anything, their blood glucose concentration never goes down because glucose can't go anywhere. Once it's in the blood, it's just trapped in the blood. Even those cells right there next to it, they're starving because they don't have glucose. Right, glucose can't get in the cells. The other thing that happens is that the liver starts to secrete glucose into the blood, so that increases blood glucose. What was the initial stimulus in this example right here? A decrease in blood glucose, the response is an increase. How do they relate to each other? They subtract, so here is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining blood glucose in the normal individual within proper physiologic parameters. All right, so in anatomy classes, I certainly talk about this principle right here, and then it's reinforced in lab this week. So here you have two hormones. One decreases blood glucose, the other increases blood glucose. Okay, why do we have this mechanism inside our bodies? And what do we call this mechanism right here, where you have two hormones that have opposite effects? Or maybe you even think of your nervous system, your autonomic nervous system. How many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? It's got two, okay? Do you know their names? Parasympathetic and sympathetic. How do they relate to each other? They're antagonistic to each other. They have opposite effects in most organs. Like parasympathetic stimulation of the heart does what? Slows it down. And sympathetic stimulation on the heart speeds it up, right? That's an antagonistic mechanism. And that is so important in control system theory because it gives you precise control and balance of that particular system if you have, right, two control inputs and they are antagonistic to each other. It means you have precise control and balance of your heart as a result of that. Well, here you have two hormones that are antagonistic to each other. It doesn't mean that it's a feudal system. Feudal meaning, you know, out of whack, inoperative, or not effective. But here you have a nice antagonistic system, and what does it provide for blood glucose concentration control? Precise control and balance, right? So that's really important. So how can you relate to this in your daily, everyday life? I got a couple examples. Okay, let's talk about in terms of anatomy. No, let's talk about an everyday example first, like your car. All right, you would never think about driving your car without these two systems that are antagonistic to each other. And what are they? Your brake and your gas pedal. Exactly right. Right, because if you have a brake and gas pedal, you have precise control of your car. That's particularly handy. I like it because when I drive home at night, if I only had a gas pedal, I could get home. But when I got home, I just have to wave goodbye because I couldn't stop, right? So antagonism is good. It's a good connotation, right? Antagonism in this particular case. In terms of anatomy, in terms of musculoskeletal control, antagonism is important. You learn a lot of muscles that are antagonistic to each other, and that is a really good thing. For instance, tomorrow night on your way home after happy hour, it's Friday night, right? You get pulled over by the person in the fancy blue uniform and the badge and the sidearm, right? And they say, okay, we think you've been drinking too much. We want you to take your index finger and put it on the tip of your nose, all right, so that you can do this with your eyes closed. I've been practicing, okay, just like that. Because you don't want to poke out the eye of the officer, right, that's pulling you over or anything. And you can tell the officer, oh, I haven't been drinking. I have precise control and balance. I have nice antagonistic control of my forearm, okay, because what two muscles are working against each other to give you that precise control and balance? The biceps for flexion and the triceps for extension. You don't want just one, right? If only the biceps was working, right, you'd give yourself a black eye. So antagonistic systems are very important for control and balance in your body. And you kind of know that already, but we'll really look at that in terms of physiology through the rest of the class. Okay, anybody have any questions on anything in this chapter so far? No? You're good? Okay, so if you see a parameter deviating from normal or the set point and it goes back down, what kind of feedback is that automatically happening? You should know. That's negative feedback. Yeah. Just 1 through 9. Now, the rest of that chapter you should be really familiar with already. And I don't think I have any particular questions on histology. Most of it is histology in the rest of that chapter. But if you look over that section and it doesn't make any sense at all, if it's totally foreign information, then you should probably read that because that was an important point of 231 anatomy. That you know something about histology. You should know something about layers and cell types and how do you talk about different, you know, cell shape, that kind of thing.
I don't know if you have any other chapters, are you also going to outline it or just certain
pages? I always, in the study guide, I tell you what page numbers you have to know. Yeah. So it's not always the whole chapter. Yeah. Yeah, so that's specifically what you're responsible for. Okay, but when, for instance, if we talk about control, transport of substances across a particular tissue, and you've forgotten all your information, what a tissue is and what they kind of look like, then you really won't be able to appreciate the physiology. So remember, anatomy is fundamental to physiology. In order to know physiology, you got to know your anatomy. Okay? Okay. There may be no specific questions, but you might not know how to answer a question unless you can remember your anatomy. All right, so let's move on to chapter 2. Okay, chemical composition of the body. And we're going to start looking at some chemicals. All right, so we're ready to go. So these are all the things we're going to talk about. We're going to start with small things, like atoms a little bit, and then move on to more complicated structures. Like molecules, for instance, and how molecules are made of atoms, and then how is it that we can join atoms together to make a molecule because of chemical bonds. So we're going to learn something about chemical bonds in here. So that's why I asked this question right here. What do opposite charges do? They attract each other, all right? And we're going to be concerned about two kinds of charges in here. It's going to be positive and negative, all right? So those are the charges that we're interested in. So let's look at an atom, right? Atoms are the smallest elements of chemistry. And as a matter of fact, atoms are things that occupy physical space. And if you have a complete vacuum like in outer space, there are no atoms up there whatsoever. It's just a complete vacuum. And atoms are made up of some subatomic particles, some smaller particles. And there are three of them. There are protons, neutrons, and electrons. Neutrons have no charge on them whatsoever. That's why we call them neutral or neutrons. Electrons, by definition, have a negative charge. And protons have a positive charge. So here are three kinds of particles. And electrons are really tiny, 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 tiny. Protons are pretty big, but the electrical charge that they have is exactly the same, but what? Opposite each other. The exact same magnitude, but opposite. So when you put an electron and a proton together, they just cancel each other out completely in terms of electrical charge. All right, they have different locations in an atom. And the model that we use in here is just a simple solar system model of how an atom is put together. Okay, and so solar system, I mean, what is a solar system? Like you have the sun, and then you have planets like our planet orbiting the sun in roughly circular orbits. And that's really not the case even for the Earth. It's a little elliptical. But the orbits in an atom are even much more different, but that's beyond this course. We can just stay with this course with something in the center that we call the nucleus that would be analogous to the sun. And in orbits around the nucleus will be electrons. So electrons are found in orbitals, right? And they're the inner orbitals are over here. Outer orbitals are farther on the outside. So sometimes people talk of these things as shells, like one orbit inside of another orbit. On the inside, this nucleus right here, this is where we find neutrons and protons. Orbitals are where we find electrons. All right, so I want you to know the two places of an atom. You've got the nucleus, and then you have orbitals or shells, and where these subatomic particles can exist. So what kind of subatomic particles can you have in the nucleus of an atom? Not the nucleus of a cell, but nucleus of an atom. Yeah. Protons and neutrons in the nucleus. So if this other example right over here, this is a carbon atom, all right, I see both neutrons, which are the dark little spheres, and protons are the lighter colored spheres right here. And then we can see some shells on the outside of the nucleus. So in shells, we have electrons only. So here is an example of a hydrogen. A hydrogen has one proton and it has one electron. So what is the overall charge of just this simple hydrogen atom? Okay. We have one positive charge in the nucleus and one negative charge in an orbital. All right, so I want to consider this whole atom right here, not just the nucleus, but the whole atom. So yeah, so remember, right, opposite charges attract each other, but they also cancel out. So this positive one electrical charge completely neutralizes this negative one charge right here. So this is an absolutely neutral kind of atom right here. All right, so orbitals and shells, and don't forget it, you've got the nucleus right here and orbitals and shells on the outside. All right, so this might be a little confusing because you know already two different definitions for a nucleus. Here's a third definition of a nucleus. A nucleus is a center of an atom that can have neutrons or protons in it. What's another definition of a nucleus that you know of? In terms of cell understanding, cell theory, right, where is a nucleus? It's inside the cell, it's an organelle, and it's membrane bound. And what does it contain? DNA genetic information, right, which is the information on how your body is built, but also how it functions. All right. What's another from another example of nucleus from anatomy? Ah, you're thinking, ah, it's rolling around in there. What's another definition of nucleus? A nucleus is a gray matter or a white matter? That's a hint. Aha, oh, it's gray matter. Right? It's gray matter. It's a group of nerve cell bodies that's not myelinated. That's why it's gray. Inside the central nervous system someplace, like the basal nuclei. Okay, I think maybe you had to know. All right, or a basal nucleus. All right, here's the third thing that you have to know. Here's the nucleus. But in terms of chemistry and atomic theory, it is what? It's the center of an atom that can have what kind of particles in it? Protons and neutrons. And which one is charged? Yeah, the proton. Okay. So you just have to realize that. All right. Now what, you know, there are different elements. There's like gold and silver, carbon, hydrogen. Here is hydrogen. Here's carbon right here. So what makes one element different from another element? What makes silver different from gold? Okay, and it has to do with what's inside the nucleus. Yeah. Okay, and it is just the number of protons inside the nucleus. If you change the number of protons inside the nucleus, guess what you change? What element it is, right? So you change it from gold to silver or whatever. And in Blackboard, I'm sure you have a copy of this thing right here. Ah, here it is. Da-da-da-da. Let me move it over. It'd be nicer if I had two projectors, but here is a table that shows, okay, all of the more common kinds of elements, and it has a certain kind of arrangement. You'll appreciate why it has this arrangement. We're going to be interested in the first couple rows of these things, okay? And it's just this number on the top right here is just the number of protons that are inside the nucleus of this particular atom. And it tells you that H, which stands for hydrogen, has how many protons in the nucleus right here? It's got one. Here is another compound that's not biologically important unless you're at a party or something, and it is helium. All right, and how many protons are inside the nucleus of this particular atom? It's got two. And we go back over to this side of the table. Here's lithium. How many protons inside this atom? Three. Right, and it just kind of marches on and on and on and on all the way down. So here, clearly, you see that different elements have different numbers of protons inside the nucleus, and indeed, that's what makes different elements different from each other. All right, so here is carbon, C. How many protons inside its nucleus? There's six. What about oxygen right here? There are eight, right? All right, so on a test, I will give you this or project it on the screen right here, and I might ask you how many protons are inside the nucleus of oxygen. All right, and so there are a couple things you have to know. That the atomic number, which is this number here on the top, is the number of protons in this particular element. But you also have to know that O stands for oxygen, because we'll use some of these formulas in class. And I have a table in your notes that shows you which chemical symbols you have to know and what element it stands for. A lot of times it's really simple, like C is carbon, N is nitrogen, O is oxygen. Okay? And let's see. Here is another one. This is one you have to know. Fe stands for iron. Okay? And that's because it's derived from the Greek word barium. And K over here stands for potassium. And you said, but potassium doesn't start with a K. It starts with a P. But that's because in Greek it's kalium. All right, so there is some memorization that you have to become familiar with. But there is another element that is P, and that stands for phosphorus. Okay, and I don't see it on here, but it's in here someplace. Okay. It's 15? Ah, really nice. Okay, phosphorus. Okay, so there's a couple little tricks that you have to be aware of. All right. And sodium doesn't start with an S. S is sulfur. And sodium is really natrium, and so it's abbreviated Na right here. And you'll be given this chart. I could ask you, what is the atomic number, or how many protons are in the nucleus of sodium? Oh, that would be a good one, because you've got to know sodium is what? Na, it's not S, and then you have to be able to use the table to tell me how many protons are inside the nucleus right there. Okay. Okay, so that's a quick overview of the periodic table. We'll use it a little bit more. Okay, so let's go on to the next slide. How did I do that? Okay, so the atomic number is just the number of protons inside the nucleus, but what do we have inside the nucleus besides protons? Neutrons. All right, so sometimes we might want to know if we add up the protons and neutrons together what that mass is, and that's called the atomic mass. And some elements will have, of course, the same number of protons inside the nucleus, but different numbers of neutrons inside the nucleus. So the atomic mass changes. That's not really important for biology, except we said that opposite charges attract, remember? So that electrons like to combine with protons because it's neutral. How is it that you get all of these protons inside the nucleus? What's the charge of this with this proton right here, where the cursor is? What's the charge of this proton right here? What's the charge? +1. What's the charge of this proton right here? +1. Okay, what's the charge of this proton here? Positive 1. So here's a corollary to this question. What do like or similar charges do? Okay, if opposite attract, similar charges repel each other. But now I'm showing you a picture where all these positive charges are nice and chummy inside the nucleus. How does that happen? You got to have neutrons in there to make things work out right, right? So all these positive charges can coexist inside the nucleus. That's why these neutrons are in here. Not too important biologically, except that some atoms that have the same number of protons, okay, have different numbers of neutrons inside the nucleus, and that makes them radioactive. All right, and so that makes them isotopes, and radioactivity is used clinically or in biology, right? Because it can release high energy, which is damaging to tissue, so it can be used to kill tumors, for instance. So you have a slide on what an isotope is. Isotopes, right, is the same kind of element, but a different number of neutrons inside the nucleus makes it radioactive. Okay. All right, so we're done with this slide right here. Almost. So here is carbon. All right, and if we look at our periodic table, how many protons are inside the nucleus of carbon? Here's carbon right here, and there are 6. All right, but carbon should be neutral. How many electrons will it have in its orbitals? It will have 6, right, and then it will be a neutral atom. And it just so happens, maybe I'll leave this right here so I can find it easier. And it just so happens that this isotope of carbon has 6 neutrons in it. So this is what we call carbon 12, right? It's got 6 protons, 6 neutrons inside the nucleus. There's also something called carbon 13. Let's just consider that for just a second. Carbon 13 is an isotope. So in order for it to be carbon, carbon 13, how many protons does it have in the nucleus? It's got to have 6. That defines it to be carbon, right? So 6 minus 13 is what? Well, 13 minus 6 is 7. So then it has 7 neutrons inside the nucleus instead of 6. That still makes it a carbon atom, but what? An isotope, because it just has a different number of neutrons. Okay, not very common kind of isotope. I think there's even called carbon what? 14. That's very radioactive. Okay. All right, so next slide. What do we got here? Oh, the little thing went out. I'm going to have a hard time finding it now. Okay. So there is a little theory that you have to know, a little game that we're going to play to know how to add electrons to an atom. All right, and remember, they're in shells outside of the nucleus. And the first shell can only accommodate 2 electrons. And we said carbon has how many? It's got 6. The first 2 fill up the first shell, the innermost shell. That means that the remaining electrons have to go to the next outside shell or orbital. So that means then that the last 4 electrons fill up an outermost shell in carbon. So I guess I'm just going to draw this really quick. Let's just do carbon right here. Kind of fast. So we got carbon. So how many protons are inside the nucleus? 6, right? So I would draw 6 of these protons inside the nucleus. We want to draw in 6 electrons. So here is the first orbital or shell around carbon. And how many electrons can we put into this shell right here? Only 2. All right, here's one here. Let's draw one right here. How many are left over? We got 4. It has to go into an outer orbital. So we can put 1, 2, 3, 4. And what are these things? These are electrons that have a minus charge. Okay. So this kind of shows you a little bit of the structure of the periodic table, but unfortunately I lost it. I put it behind the slide. I'd have to close the program to get it. Maybe I won't get it. Maybe I will. Let's see what happens. Okay, so now this is carbon, and it is electrically neutral. Okay. The second shell can take up to 8 electrons, even though it only has 4 right here. All right. The most important thing I want you to see with this diagram right here is that we want to put atoms together to form molecules. And the way molecules are formed when we add atoms together is through something called a chemical bond. Chemical bond allows atoms to be put together to make molecules. And what allows bonds to form are these electrons that make up an atom, but only particular ones, only ones in the outermost shell. The ones on the inside don't participate in forming chemical bonds. So these have a special name. These are called valence electrons, the ones in the outermost shell. Okay, we talked about isotopes already. All right, so here are the elements that you have to know. You've got to know oxygen, carbon, all the way down to magnesium. And you got to know chromium all the way down to zinc right here. Because in lecture and lab, we don't have time always to spell out magnesium. So we're going to be using these chemical symbols. So all those things on the periodic table, you don't have to know, but these ones here you do. You don't have to know this third column over here, the percentage by body weight. It's kind of interesting to look at that, okay, in your body. But this is what you have to know, that S stands for sulfur. Capital C, little L, stands for chlorine. All right, and then you should be able to use the periodic table to tell me how many protons are in the nucleus, for instance, of Mg, which stands for magnesium. You could look that up. Oh, you know, I'd really like to have that periodic table here. Okay. And we used to have one hanging out in the room, but it got put away. See, can I grab it anywhere? No, I can't grab it. As soon as I click, I go to the next slide. All right, so is everybody clear? You got to know that the English word and the chemical symbol for these elements right here, like fluorine, iodine, iron, you have to know these. All right, so let's talk about, yeah. Purpose of trace elements is that, okay, here's the concept. Here we have a hand, okay, and I have a nice thumb and an index finger, and I still can oppose. The motion is opposition, which means I can grasp objects with my hand because I have a thumb and a finger. Now let's just say, unfortunately, I have an accident, all right, and maybe I lose my thumb right here. It gets chopped off. What happens to, since now the structure of my hand has changed, what happens to the physiology of my hand? It changes as well, okay? So the structure of something pretty much defines what its physiology is. The anatomy of something determines what the physiology is. The structure of something will determine how it can function, all right? So the same thing for molecules. If you change the shape of a molecule, guess what you change? The physiology, how it can participate in chemistry or physiology of your body. So you might have a molecule like adenosine triphosphate, an important energy molecule, but it can't be used in your body unless maybe, for instance, this little magnesium ion is available to bind to it. And so when you change the structure of that ATP, you can change how ATP is used in the body. As a matter of fact, you can turn it on or off. Having the ability to turn things on or off is really handy. Like, give me an example. Light switch, when you want a light, ignition switch on your car. So by simply changing the shape of a molecule, by maybe having a little trace element around, can change activity of enzymes, which changes the physiology inside the cell. But you don't need a lot of it. You just need a tiny, tiny little bit of it because it doesn't act as structure for your body, not like collagen. It just acts like a little controlling element that can turn things on or off. Okay, chemical bonds. What's the important structure in an atom that allows for chemical bonds to take place? Valence electrons, right? Electrons in the outer shell within an atom. Okay, so molecules formed by chemical bonds between valence electrons, different ways I could ask that question, right? The number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete the outermost shell. How many electrons can we put in an outer shell?
Eight.
And when that outer shell is completely filled up with electrons, that's a very stable atom. Then it's happy. But if it is missing electrons in its valence shell, like this one here, this is carbon, it's missing four, it's an unstable, it's an unhappy atom. This atom right here is looking for what? For four electrons, okay, to become stable. Now, this funny thing is when it adds electrons, then it disturbs the neutrality with this nucleus right here. So we're going to look at that to see that there are different kinds of chemical bonds. And as a matter of fact, I think on this slide you should write down a big letter 4. There are 4 kinds of chemical bonds that I want you to be aware of. And we're going to fill that in the next couple of lectures. Okay, the first kind, a covalent bond. So number 1 is covalent. And what happens here is that valence electrons are shared in a covalent bond. So put a circle around share and have it point up to covalent over here. So shared is a good key bullet term to understand for covalent bonds. All right, so here we have an atom that has one proton inside the nucleus. Ooh, where's my periodic table? Anybody can remember their periodic table? Guess what? Sorry. I'm just going to have to go find it. Here it is, and then I'll stick it over here so that I can get to it a little bit later on, which means then I'll start the show again, get my pointer back. Okay. So what element has one proton inside the nucleus? Okay. Hydrogen right here, it's got one. Okay, so that just helps you get a little familiarity. So if it has one proton inside the nucleus, how many electrons does it have? It's got one electron. All right, and remember, how many electrons can fit in this valence orbital right here? Two. As a matter of fact, hydrogen is not very happy unless there are two in there. And it can find one if it bumps into another hydrogen atom because the hydrogen atom right here has one electron, and these two atoms are very happy to share these two, and they can wander around anywhere over these two orbitals, thereby thinking that this nucleus has two electrons, and this nucleus here has two electrons, so it becomes very stable. And so these two atoms are doing what with these electrons? They're sharing. One nucleus is not grabbing an electron and keeping it. It is actually giving up one, but it's also partially using the one from this other hydrogen atom. So these are being shared right here. And that forms a fairly stable molecule. And these electrons are shared equally. Sometimes they're both going to be found over here. Sometimes they're going to be both found over here. But they're zipping around very fast, right? Speed of light around in this region. Right, and so we can see that for hydrogen as well as oxygen gas. Maybe we'll build an oxygen molecule in a little bit. So this right here we call a nonpolar covalent bond because these electrons are shared equally between each other. Next slide. Okay, here is, what molecule is this? I see an oxygen and I see two molecules of hydrogen. So even before you take a chemistry class, you know this is water, H2O. All right? And H2O is what we call a polar compound because these covalent bonds right here are shared unequally. But let's go ahead and build this molecule very quickly. Let me get this periodic table back over here. All right, well, we know how many electrons does a hydrogen have? It's got one. Okay, what about oxygen? How many protons does oxygen have? It's got 8. So let's draw out oxygen on the board right here. As a matter of fact, I could use this diagram. So it's got 8 pluses inside the nucleus. All right, so it's got 8 pluses. So that means it's going to have 8 electrons. And how does that affect its valence electrons? Well, the first two go where? The first shell, I didn't think I passed around. Oh, there's a sign-in sheet. I did. Okay. Don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. I just freaked out. It's like, oh, it's almost time to go. But let's just build a water molecule really fast. 8 electrons. So there's 2 in the first. So that leaves how many? 6. But we drew in 4 already. We got to draw in how many more? 2 more. All right. So let's draw in one here and one here. In order for this oxygen atom to be happy and stable, how many electrons does it need? It needs 8, okay, but in this outer shell, it needs 8, but it's only got 6, so it needs what? 2 more. Where can it get an electron from? Hydrogen, which has 1 proton, and it's got an electron in an orbital right here. So here is another electron, so there is what? Hydrogen. And then over here, we can draw another hydrogen atom that has how many electrons in its valence shell? 1. All right, so here is a nice covalent bond. These electrons are being shared between what? Oxygen and 2 hydrogens making an H2O molecule of water. Where we're going to start next time is that we see that if we add up all the protons and all of the electrons, they're going to exactly cancel each other. But there's something special happening with this oxygen that we're going to look at that makes this a polar molecule. And polar just means that it has an opposite nature on different ends of the molecule. Just like the Earth is polar because the magnetic field is different on the North Pole compared to the South Pole. Is this a what?
What kind of bond is that?
This is a covalent bond because these electrons are being shared unequally. It's still covalent. It makes a huge difference in how it behaves in our body, but it's still covalent. Polar bonds and nonpolar bonds make a huge difference.
Right.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, you can't understand much of physiology or pharmacology or anything if you don't understand polar and nonpolar, but it's still covalent. There's still covalent bonds. Yeah.